Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. Despite my interest in history and all the things that one can learn from history, I'm constantly thinking about the future, the near future and the distant future, and what lies ahead for all of us. Recently, I've been looking at a bunch of things to do with Ben Clausen, the creator of the Church of Creativity. And I made a bunch of really interesting discoveries, which I want to go and revisit as a separate video. But I must tell you that Ben Clausen impresses the hell out of me. What I really like about Ben Clausen is his level of intellect and his level of deep thinking. Ben Clausen really was a good thinker. I think when it comes to America and even to whites post World War II, Ben Clausen is the greatest thinker since Hitler. We haven't had someone who could think so deeply and so accurately. Ben Clausen truly did excellent work. What really astounded me was I stumbled on a book that Ben Clausen had written, which was basically his own biography. And he'd written a biography of his own life, and then why he started discovering that Jews are a problem. And Ben Clausen started out his life as a good guy. He was just yet another guy going and growing up and starting to work and just minding his own business and working. But even when Ben Clausen was working, because he was working and growing up at the time of Hitler, he was pro-Hitler, but he was living in Canada. And Ben Clausen's life is actually quite fascinating, and it allowed me to get an idea of him as a person. Because nowadays, whenever I speak to anyone about Ben Clausen, they always just look at Ben Clausen, the old man who then went and committed suicide, and he'd written the White Man's Bible and Nature's Eternal Religion in the 70s. And pretty much there's not much else to know about Ben Clausen. But actually, Ben Clausen is damn fascinating. He's a really fascinating person with a very fascinating life story, actually. So I want to return to the Church of Creativity and Ben Clausen's work. But what's interesting about Ben is the story of how Ben Clausen was just a businessman. He went and he got himself a degree. And then off he went, and he was doing work, and the next thing you know is he gets himself into America, and then he ends up in the property market in America, and that actually gave him a really good life. Ben Clausen actually traveled a hell of a lot. He was actually a very much go-getter kind of a guy. And he got married, and I must tell you that in the icons of the white right since World War II, probably Ben Clausen and Tom Metzger had the most successful marriages. And Ben Clausen and his wife, they stuck together right to the end, and she died before him. And Ben Clausen was actually a very intellectual guy, and he invented stuff. And he did stuff, and he was a go-getter. But then he began to notice by the 1960s that, you know what, there's something wrong here in America. And he started digging around. And Ben Carson and George Lincoln Rockwell of the American Nazi Party. Here you've got two intelligent white guys with totally different backgrounds. And these two white men are starting to see things are going wrong. And each one engages in an investigation, and each one reaches the same conclusion. They start out just by joining, like, the John Birch Society and that sort of thing. And then, given time, each one of them eventually realizes we got two problem peoples that are really gonna stuff up America. And at the top of the list is Jews. And the next group of people is blacks. Blacks are big trouble. But the history of Ben Carson is actually quite amazing because Ben Carson had more money than George Lincoln Rockwell ever had, and he was older and he was much more better placed in society. So Ben Carson was higher up in society. He had money, he had friends, and he was doing things that guys like George Lincoln Rockwell couldn't do, things that Dr. William Pierce couldn't do, because Dr. William Pierce at that point was a young guy. Ben Carson actually is a very fascinating man. And he's actually highly skilled, very highly skilled. But Ben Carson has got one failure, and his failure is that he doesn't know anything about the military. And that is where George Lincoln Rockwell is the total opposite of him. George Lincoln Rockwell is military through and through. So all of these men who've got different backgrounds and different strengths and weaknesses, there are many fascinating things that come out of studying them, and there are things that one can learn from all of them. They are very fascinating people, actually. And each one has got his stuff that he brought to the white right. But Ben Carson, as a thinker and a long-term strategist, he's good. I'd say that the next best is Dr. William Pierce. Dr. William Pierce is a good thinker, definitely. There are people that I know about, but you'll never hear me mention them in my videos. Sometimes it's just that I haven't got around to them. Like, there's a certain Englishman, I forget his name now, but he was actually a Nazi and a very good guy. He created the British National Party. But then there's a guy like David Duke. I know quite a bit about David Duke, and I know it from people who knew him very well. David Duke is the only guy on the white right in America who ever got to a point where he could run for president of the United States. And when he did, he got a lot of money. Whites poured a lot of money into trying to get David Duke to make it as the president of the United States. And that guy got money like no guy in the white right, in the history of the white right, ever had. I'm talking the history of the white right in America since World War II. And people were so upset with him by the end of his campaign, etc. And I did get a chance to talk to Tom Metzger in the last few years of his life. And I took quite a liking to Tom Metzger. And I think that as someone who did stuff in the 1980s in America, I think that the two great guys of the 1980s were Tom Metzger in America and Ernst Zundel in Canada. Those guys were fighters, and Tom Metzger is a very sharp man. Tom Metzger probably spread the word and did good shows and really was high quality. So I've got a lot of respect for Tom Metzger as a guy who went and waged his own war, in the same way that Ernst Zundel waged his war. And, Zundel with David Irving and the Jews doing their utmost, basically world Jewry ganging up on old Ernst Zundel. I don't think that world Jewry has ganged up on a white man like they've ganged up on Ernst Zundel. The last white man before that world Jewry ganged up on was Hitler. But old Ernst Zundel, he gave the Jews a good hard clobbering between him and David Irving and the whole team of brilliant white guys who were involved in all of that, Douglas Christie, Fred Leuchter, and all those people. Those guys, they gave the Jews a nightmare. Between Zundel and let's call it the Zundel team, they clobbered the Jews. They gave the Jews a clobbering like the Jews have never had since World War II, where they took on that Holocaust crap and tore it to shit. In many ways, Ernst Zundel is the, quotes, George Lincoln Rockwell of Canada. He laid the foundations for the white right in Canada. But returning to Ben Clausen, some things about Ben Clausen. I like lots and lots of things that Ben Clausen did. Anyway, Ben Clausen, in his later years, began to focus on the black problem. And he was saying to young guys in America, he was saying to them, "You are going to have to live, with this black plague, and they are going to make your life impossible." But because Ben Clausen didn't have a knowledge of military stuff, Ben Clausen saw the black plague as something that would overwhelm the whites. Interestingly enough, Ben Clausen was talking in military terms, even though he wasn't military. He was already starting to talk in those terms in the mid-1980s. Here we've got the border problem on the southern border of America with Mexico. And Ben Clausen in the 1980s was already saying and talking about the border problem. And Ben Clausen was saying, "You need machine guns. You need machine guns to solve this problem." And my favorite thing that Ben Clausen did is Ben Clausen came up with RAHOA. RAHOA meaning racial holy war. And basically, Ben Clausen declared a RAHOA, in other words, a white jihad. Ben Clausen declared a jihad for whites, I think, in about 1989. So technically, we're at war already. Our Pontifex Maximus, our high priest, Ben Clausen, has already declared a race war on behalf of whites. We're already at war. Ben Clausen declared war back in 1989. We are already in a state of war. But Ben Clausen was very concerned that blacks flooding in would drown out the whites and that the whites wouldn't be able to survive. And I myself, in the 1980s, was also wondering about the ability of whites to survive in a black society. But by the mid-1980s, I was hearing from the one-third of the Rhodesians who'd remained in Zimbabwe, I was already hearing stories that the whites are rocking, that the whites are going from strength to strength. So the amazing thing was that when there are quite a few whites, even if they only make up 1% of the population, which is what they were in Zimbabwe, they can actually do very well. And the thing that amazed me was that they could do very well in a communist society, in a black communist society. And that society had lots and lots of rules. The whites had lots of rules that they had to comply with. There were stacks of things against them. They actually had it harder than we whites in South Africa, actually. But despite all the good news of the mid-1980s, within 20 years, the government was smashing the whites, and the black government was smashing the whites because of the white success, because the whites were becoming so strong that they were able to get other blacks to work with them, and they were actually getting ready to take on the government. That's a topic that I need to get back to. But Ben Carson was worried that when there are too many blacks, that the whites would just die out in America, that the whites would not be able to survive. But whites have got a tremendous amount of ability, or to use Ben Carson's term, creativity. We are clever. We are creative, we're not stupid. So that is why I tell Americans and Canadians and European whites, even if you are less than 40%, you're still good to go. You can probably destroy the blacks and the non-whites. You can probably destroy them all, even if you're down to about 20% of the population. Even if you're down to 20% of the population, you can destroy them all as long as you know your military stuff. Now, the interesting thing is what happens when the blacks and the Jews and everybody else become a large number in your society, and their numbers are growing and growing versus yours. And they're outnumbering you. What then? Well, the lesson from here in Africa is quite bizarre, yet totally logical. And as I grew up and started watching and studying the countries here in Africa, I began to realize that the irony of it is that as the blacks become more and more, and they take more and more power, that as bizarre as it sounds, the more power they have, the more unstable they become. The reason they could never compete with whites to begin with is simply that these people are idiots, their society is a stuff up, their IQ is low. And if you put them in all the positions of power and they get to do more and more of what they want to do, the irony is that their society actually becomes weaker. So let me just state that clearly, that if blacks run their own country and blacks take over everything, I mean everything, okay? They get political power, they get military power, they get economic power, they control the police, they make the laws, etc., etc. That these people are so inept and their society is so dysfunctional. And even as their own population grows more and more, you will find it hard to believe, but their society becomes weirder and weirder, and it starts to actually fall apart. And it falls apart at so many levels. And the more that I study history, the more I am reaching the conclusion that what we're going to see in the future is a repeat of the past. And when I look at whites and blacks, hundreds of years ago, when whites came to Africa and blacks had spears and lived in huts, and whites came with a couple of muskets and things, the more that I'm looking at the situation in the past, I'm starting to say to myself that we're going to see an exact rerun of that. Because there are so many aspects of modern times that are actually no different to back then. You know, I used to say that the whites fought the blacks with just the whites having the muskets and the blacks having spears. But in actual fact, in more recent times, when the Boers became a greater power in South Africa and the Boers were starting to found their own countries, I've actually found battles and situations where the blacks actually had modern weaponry, where the blacks actually got muskets and weapons from whites. They bought it from traders. And the more I look at things, I'm saying to myself, but hold on, that's exactly the same as now. About the only difference between whites and blacks fighting in the 21st century is going to be that the fighting will take place in countries where the infrastructure is Western, because all of Africa is westernized and the blacks in America are living in a Western country. The only difference is that the infrastructure is going to be westernized, and that in actual fact all other aspects are exactly the same. So the only thing that's different is that the blacks aren't living in huts. That's the only difference. In all other respects, the blacks will outnumber the whites, but the blacks aren't just totally helpless. The blacks of modern times have access to modern weaponry, but ironically, 150 years ago, blacks did have access to modern weaponry, and they did use it in battle against whites. And it still did not save them from being clobbered by the whites. The more I'm looking at things, the more I'm saying to myself that if we want to know the future is going to play itself out by race. That all the things that we know about race will play itself out right in front of our eyes. And among the great things is that every freaking liberal and Jewish thing that you ever heard is gonna fall flat on its face. You will see that the Jewish rat has done nothing more than confuse whites and delude people for a period of time while the Jew rat has been stuffing the money into his pockets. And we might even be lucky enough in our lifetimes, we might even be lucky enough to see Jews fleeing. We might even be lucky enough to see Jews flee from the West. And most of the Jews have already left South Africa, and I published an article the other day about Anglo Gold. Anglo American is owned by the Jewish Oppenheimers. The Jewish Oppenheimers are basically the Rothschild agents for South Africa. The Oppenheimers basically owned South Africa. They were the owners of South Africa. In the 1960s, they might have owned 70% of South Africa's economy. And I've been watching. They have clearly been doing things quietly, and I noticed that they disappeared off the lists of the richest people in Africa. They disappeared off the lists of the richest people in South Africa. And I saw an article the other day that Anglo Gold is moving away. They've already listed on the New York Stock Exchange. The bad news for the Americans is that your Jewish infestation is increasing in intensity, and I see that Joe Biden is now allowing Israelis to go to America without visas. So not even the most basic amount of background checking on Jews. So the American Jewish infestation is going to carry on growing. And now you've even got the South African Jew scum like the Oppenheimers also listing on the New York Stock Exchange. They had already listed on the London Stock Exchange quite a few years ago, and they were already reducing their presence here in South Africa a long time ago, possibly even more than 20 years ago. One of the good things that I'm starting to watch with these Jews and blacks is I've come to the conclusion that the Jews were nowhere nearly as successful at controlling the blacks as they hoped they would be. And there were quite a few signs to me that the Jews, even the hardcore communist Jews, even the richest Jews in South Africa, are reaching a point where they are just not able to get the results out of the blacks that they were hoping for, that they are reaching a point where they themselves can't stand it anymore. So Jewry has created the black plague, or rather not created it, because it was created by whites under colonialism. We fed the blacks, we looked after them, we stopped their babies from dying when we should have just left it to nature. There were so many things that we did to help these ungrateful, worthless people. But Jews were the ones that unleashed blacks on Western civilization, especially in modern times, unleashing black Africans into Europe and America. But I must tell you that looking closely at the Jews of South Africa and various things that I watched, the good news for whites is that Jews overrated themselves. Jews thought they could control blacks, and they can't control blacks, and they themselves are tired of it. One of the best examples I saw was when I went to the book launch of the Jew Ronnie Casserolls in January 2020, because I recorded him at that book launch, and 90% of the people who were there were a bunch of Jews. And so all these Jews were busy blabbering to each other, and I was sitting there and I was listening. And one of the things that came out was that here is this Jew, Casserolls, who was a commie Jew. He was basically a Jewish soldier, a terrorist actually. He was blowing up stuff in South Africa in the 1960s. So anyway, Casserolls went on to become the highest ranking Jew in the South African government under black rule. At his peak, he was the Minister of Intelligence. He was basically in charge of the spies. That's basically what he was. And Casserolls, in recent years, actually left politics. And when I was sitting there listening to him blabbering to the other Jews, he said that the blacks were actually asking him to return to politics, to go back to politics, and he said to them no. And I began to form the opinion that Casserolls, who'd been with the blacks since the 1960s and had spent his entire life with the blacks fighting against whites, that this Jew is actually tired of the blacks. And he no longer cares about what's happening among the blacks. And he's actually starting to turn to whites in order to fool whites. And That was a big takeaway for me. That said to me that this Jew spent his entire life with blacks, and he's reached a point where he sees that you can't handle these people, you can't deal with these people, and that's a good sign. So if the black and Jew thing doesn't work out, which it definitely isn't working out in South Africa, that's great news. And Jews are quietly leaving out of this hellhole that they played a big role in creating to begin with. But everywhere, whites can still pick up the pieces, don't you worry. For us, the end game is to return to our old military ways, and we will sort out all these people that are out of control. We will have to do what the Germans had to do. So returning to Ben Carson, as much as Ben Carson was a racialist, Ben Carson lacked military experience. And of course, there are things that even I did not know about the future and about the interactions between blacks and whites until I myself was closer to the coal face and I lived through it and I could actually see things more clearly from personal experience. So when I worked with blacks and as more and more blacks came into organizations, I could start forming opinions and actually seeing on a day-to-day basis how do whites survive among blacks. And I've seen many things that indicate to me that, you know what, black society is fucked up. By our standards, black society is fucked up. And these people, it doesn't matter whether there is 10 million of them, or 100 million of them, or a billion of them, these people don't amount to much, and they aren't a big threat to whites. Whites can clobber them. And I have reached the conclusion in recent decades that there's no such time as the end of the game. It doesn't matter what our situation is, you can always invent new tactics and fight back again. The beauty is that we are never too buggered that we can't fight back. So let me turn to a little bit of American history, and I want to tell you a story. And it is an interesting survival story from America, because this relates also to our future and the instability that's coming. Sometime in the 1980s, I got hold of a book called The Day the Bubble Burst. And it was a book about the American stock market and the Wall Street crash of 1929. Among our own problems in the future is how unstable are the stock markets of the world and could we have crashes again in our lifetime. We've already had a very nasty incident, which was the 2008 market meltdown. That thing, I want to repeat, was on such a scale that it had the total potential to bring down the entire banking system of America and the world. I'm not exaggerating when I say that. But it does seem as though they've managed to sort of patch things up. But the way things are rolling, it could break again, but we don't know when. And when so many people are fiddling with things in so many ways, there comes a time where it becomes almost impossible to actually predict. So it will break one day, and we'll see what happens. But it probably won't break as much as 1929 stock market crash, because they got all kinds of things in place these days. They've got computers that are monitoring the markets, computers making the deals. The computer systems can slow down when the prices are falling. They've got all kinds of things in place. So probably the worst thing that will happen is that when things start breaking, they'll start slowing down the trading and shutting down the markets for a couple of days to give people a chance to not panic so much, etc. But we are heading for something along that line somewhere in the future. It could happen in 2 years' time, it could happen in 20 years' time. And when I look at the way the US government handles things, I think the US government will just print endless amounts of money so that it doesn't go down. They are doing all kinds of crazy things. But let's return to the past because there are some very interesting lessons from the past. Because in the past, things were a lot wilder and people weren't such a bunch of sissies. And whites handled all kinds of harsh situations without being a bunch of crybabies. The Day the Bubble Burst was a very fascinating book written in 1980, and it was a good, fun book to read, I must tell you. And it was all about the wealthy people in America before the 1929 stock market crash, and then after the crash. What happened after the crash? And so there was also this kind of feeling back then. It's the same bullshit that has happened in the last 30 years. In other words, the 1920s, especially in America, was a time of tremendous growth and everything, and it was just everybody's getting richer and richer and richer. And after a time, they were saying, you know what, stock market crashes aren't going to happen anymore. The good times are here to stay. The rules no longer apply to us. It's just going to be onwards and upwards. And then, of course, there are a couple of people who do wonder, you know, is it maybe a dodgy thing, this? Can this thing go wrong? Now, in that book, it was the first time that I'd heard of a guy called Jesse Livermore. And if you look on the screen in front of you, the top middle picture is a photo of Jesse Livermore. And I must tell you that the stories around Jesse Livermore fascinated me. And I found Jesse Livermore to be a very fascinating character, actually. And in the bottom middle, you'll see Jesse Livermore between two women. And Jesse Livermore was a stock market trader. And like lots of the whites of those times, he was also somebody who came from nowhere, didn't have much of a background, but his IQ started working for him. And he actually learned how to start trading, but he didn't trade on the stock market. He traded in other things. He learned how to trade in places known as bucket shops. A bucket shop was a type of miniature stock market. And he went and he worked there and he was doing his bit of work as a youngster, and the bucket shops had all the prices, and they were writing the prices on chalk boards, etc. So this young guy who's just doing his little bit of work, he actually starts beginning to think, and his white brain starts working, and he begins to think that he can actually tell whether the prices are going to go up and down. And that's really where the story of Jesse Livermore begins. I have got a little video about Jesse Livermore, which you can watch at the end of this video, and it'll give you a little bit of an idea about Jesse Livermore. But Jesse Livermore was really quite a trader in his day, and He also had a love of beautiful women. I think he was married 3 times, but all in all, he wasn't a bad guy. What I found quite fascinating about Jesse Livermore when I was reading that book, Jesse Livermore really stood out to me, was Jesse Livermore had started in the bucket shops, and then he thought, what about the stock market? If you can make money in the bucket shops, you can make money on the stock market. He went to the stock market and he was wiped out because there were things that were different between the stock market and the bucket shops. Then he went back to the bucket shops and he made more money for himself again in the bucket shops until he had money and he went back to the stock market. Jesse Livermore was so good at making money at those bucket shops that he was banned from them. And that's also how he ended up at the stock market the first time. So when he was wiped out at the stock market, he had to go back to bucket shops, but he had to sort of sneak around and find a way to do it so that people didn't know who he was. He was that freaking good. But where he's really cool, and what really fascinated me in the book was Jesse Livermore began to specialize in being a bear. In the stock markets, a bull is somebody who buys and holds on to stock, and the stock prices go up. But Jesse Livermore was a bear, and a bear is somebody who sells stock that is going to go down. And the way in which they are able to sell stock that they don't own is through a technique known as shorting. So there's a mechanism in the stock market where somebody can short a stock. And so you can short a stock, and basically, shorting is when you sell first and you buy later. So instead of doing like a bull, where you buy first and you sell later, a bear sells first and buys later. So the bear sells when he thinks the price is high, and then he's got a certain amount of time in which to buy, but he has to buy within a certain period of time. I can't remember if it's like 30 days or something. And he has to buy. But he's betting that the price is going to be lower. So he sells first, and then if he's done his analysis correctly, he can buy at a lower price and then he makes a profit. But if the price has gone up since he did the sale, then he's got to buy back at a higher price and then he makes a loss. Anyhow, Jesse Livermore had his own office. And Jesse Livermore became the great bear of Wall Street. And Jesse Livermore made tons of money by shorting stocks when they go down. And he was a tactician, man. And Jesse Livermore worked out methods of doing it. And Jesse Livermore could spread panic in the stock market. And people would go crazy and they'd start selling and they'd lose so much money and people would panic and more people would panic. And Jesse Livermore comes in and he buys up the stocks dirt cheap. He's made a killing. So for me, it was fascinating to read about the concept of someone making money when prices are falling. And Jesse Livermore was awesomely fun, and I really enjoyed reading the life story of Jesse Livermore. But after the 1929 stock market crash, strangely, by the time World War II started, believe it or not, Jesse Livermore actually was battling and struggling. And can you believe that Jesse Livermore later went and committed suicide? And that was really quite sad, and I think it's kind of pathetic as well. I'm not in favor of committing suicide, and I don't think that there is ever a need to commit suicide. Except if you are in a situation like Hitler was, for example, where you know that they're going to come and kill you, and they're going to kill you for sure. So you take your life because you know they're going to kill you. So in that sense, Hitler and Goebbels and others were right. They knew that you are facing an enemy that is going to execute you. Goering beat them to the punch, etc. So I understand why those guys did it. But for a guy like Jesse Livermore, I don't think that he had a real need for that. He wrote a note to his wife and he said to her that he is a failure and that he can't support her, something along those lines. So Jesse Livermore possibly got too soft from the good life. And when he was younger and leaner and meaner, he was awesome, but he got too soft and spoiled from the good life. And then when things went wrong, he just quit on life, which I don't think is right. That's where the soldiers are much tougher than these business people types. Anyhow, I absolutely loved the story of Jesse Livermore, especially as a bear on Wall Street. I found it absolutely fascinating, his tactics. There's even a book written about it, which you can go and read. And it's about the life of a stock operator. So that comes from the soft world of business. But there was another guy who also did very well in the 1929 stock market crash, and that is none other than a guy called Joseph P. Kennedy, the guy you see there on the top left of the screen. And Joseph P. Kennedy is the patriarch of the Kennedy family, and he goes on to be the father of John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy. He's got 9 children in all. And Joe Kennedy is generally a good guy, all round a pretty good white guy. You cannot say that Joe Kennedy hurt our race or did anything negative. Like many men, he was also naughty. Just like Jesse Livermore had a liking for the pretty girls, Joe Kennedy did have an affair. But all in all, Joe Kennedy is a good guy. But again, with Joe Kennedy, like with Jesse Livermore, you've got a white guy and he isn't really much to begin with, but then he discovers the power of his DNA. He discovers the power of his brain, and Joe Kennedy becomes a success, and he goes on to do lots and lots of things. Joe Kennedy actually lived a very full life, and he was good at lots of things. And the survival tip that we're going to look at today is actually a survival tip from Joe Kennedy. So in those, quotes, roaring 20s, as the stock markets were going up, the good times were here, never to turn into bad times. It's just going to be upwards, onwards, more money and more money. And you're just going to get richer, and then you're going to get a lot more richer, and then you're going to get even richer still. That was the kind of outlook of the 1920s. But it came to a sticky end. Now, we, in the current time, we are in a similar kind of mindset, except in this case, it's lasted more than 30 years. 30 years of liberalism and globalism and bullshit. And whites have learned all about the shopping mall life, etc. And we think that things can't go sour. But it will go sour. And as you can see with the Black Plague and the Jewish Plague, you'll see that things are getting worse and weirder and creepier and nastier, and that, you know, all that shopping mall and money stuff is starting to lose its shine, is starting to lose its meaning. So in the 1920s, like in all stock markets that fly upwards and then they crash hard, initially you just got the normal business people and so forth who are in the stock market. But as time goes by and the money starts pouring in, then more and more people start getting involved in the stock market. So everyone was focusing on money and the stock market. But markets cannot go up forever unless the government, of course, does things the way that they're doing it nowadays. If it wasn't for the US government and the Fed pumping things up, the markets would have collapsed, you know, 20 years ago. Things would have sorted itself out. Probably things would have sorted itself out back in 2008. The big crash would have been in 2008. Everything would have collapsed. The super rich would be jumping off buildings. People would be hanging themselves, shooting themselves. And then we would have returned to sanity. But instead, we are moving into greater insanity. But in the 1920s, the US government wasn't that insane. Back then, if you were an idiot, you paid the price. So if you made money when it went up and you lost money when it went down, you know, bummer for you. That's your responsibility. You're an adult. So there was the concern among a few people that, you know, what if everybody is getting into the stock market and there comes a time where, you know, too many people are in the stock market, that, you know, that could be the end of the bull market. In other words, the good times, that this thing's going to turn around. Well, there's a story that I read in that book, The Day the Bubble Burst, and it was the story about Joe Kennedy. If you look in the bottom left of the picture, you'll see a young white guy and he's busy shining the shoes of a older man. The shoeshine boy. So back then, there were lots of shoeshine boys there in Wall Street, and they were making a little bit of money by shining the shoes of other white men. And notice, the whites in those days dressed better than we are dressed today. Nowadays we dress like blacks, we dress like shit. Thanks to liberalism and diversity and merging our standards with the low standards of others, so now white people don't even dress decently anymore. But anyway, there were lots of shoeshine boys who were shining the shoes of the rich men. So one day, Joe Kennedy went and he had his shoes shined. And the shoeshine boy was telling him that he's also trading in the stock market. And afterwards, Joe Kennedy really thought about this and he thought, what? The shoeshine boy is trading in the stock market. And that was a big red flag for him. There are various accounts of what exactly the shoeshine boy said and did, and I'll just read one or two of them because nobody knows exactly. But here's one from Reddit. In 1929, multimillionaire investor Joe Kennedy Sr. was having his shoes shined with the added benefit of receiving generous and unsolicited investment advice from the shoeshine boy. For the future patriarch of the Kennedy political dynasty, the combination of the young man's confidence and ignorance was the signal that investor sentiment had become irrationally exuberant. Kennedy promptly returned to his office, sold his entire stock portfolio, and used the proceeds to short the market, that is, bet that stock prices would decline. Shortly thereafter, an epic market crash occurred, leading to ruins for many, but vast riches for Kennedy, or so the story goes. Here's another version of the story. There's an investment legend that in 1929, Joseph Kennedy, father of the late US president, living in New York City, stopped on a street to get his shoes shined. At the time, shoeshine boys were ubiquitous in the business district of New York. The shoeshine boy offered Joe some stock tips. Joe decided that when even shoeshine boys are offering stock tips, it's time to get out of the market. He sold off his entire portfolio immediately, and the crash came soon after, leaving him with his wealth intact at a time when so many others had lost theirs. The best I can remember from the day the bubble burst is the version that Joe Kennedy just sold his entire holdings in the stock market and Joe Kennedy pulled out. He didn't short the market. And Joe Kennedy went and did other things with his money, and shortly everyone else was wiped out, but Joe Kennedy was rocking. His fortune was still intact. So basically, the moral of the story is that when everybody can get into the market and when even the shoeshine boy has got the ability to get into the market, that it's a sign that this is the end, that too many people have gotten in, and if the shoeshine boy is in the market, then there isn't much more money that can come into the market. The shoeshine boy is at the bottom rung of society, and if he gets in, then you must know all of society has exhausted its money on the stock market, and the market can't continue upwards. And Joe Kennedy looked at that and said, it's time to get out. I'm getting out. This thing can't function anymore. So this is not a case of knocking the young white guys who were learning and just trying to do their best with their little bit of money. They also were trying to learn and make a few bucks, etc. It is really a example of a commentary on the state of society at that point in time. But it is a red flag. It's a red flag that says, you know what? Society is so bad now that there's only one direction from here onwards, and that direction is down. The other day I was in a bank here in South Africa at my bank. There were some things that I needed done. And that particular bank where I am is a bank that 40 years ago, it was actually part of the banks that were created by the Broederbond. This was part of the Afrikaans banking network that existed when I first came to South Africa. Back then, the banks were totally first world, run by whites, etc. And this is now the same banking group when all of those banks were now merged, and it's now 40 years later. And if you go there now, every single employee in the bank is black. When I worked in the bank, even just a couple of years ago before I was driven out, there were still a couple of whites in the banking branches. There were still a couple of Indians and coloureds in the banking branches. But I've noticed, as I've walked around the shopping malls, I've noticed that every single bank in South Africa now, every bank, all the major banks, their entire complement of staff is black. Everybody is black. You don't see one Indian, you don't see one colored, you don't see one white. Of course, they wouldn't be able to function if it wasn't for the computer systems that we had written for them. Those computer systems are still running. Now, in America, that man, that waste of white skin, known as Joe Biden, who is medically unfit to be the President of the United States. Have you noticed how Joe Biden has been bringing blacks in every freaking place that is conceivable? Even that stupid black woman who is the spokesperson for the White House. That was a Joe Biden thing. I used to actually watch press conferences of the White House, even when Biden was in power. And I didn't mind listening to the liberals, the white liberals and all that. But when Biden brought in that black woman, that's the moment that I stopped listening to any White House press conference. I just couldn't handle it that the White House press secretary is black. To me, that was just too much. And I stopped following any press conferences further. I didn't want to look at it even. That Joe Biden is such a sack of shit from every conceivable angle. He's such an anti-white piece of white crap. He's right there in the same level as the Clintons. I just cannot stand that man. And I don't know how many of you know or have taken notice of another thing that Joe Biden has done. If you look on the right of the screen in front of you, you'll see that there's somebody else that Joe Biden has promoted. That the headline in the New York Times says, General Charles Brown became the nation's highest ranking officer. The 4-star Air Force fighter pilot will take over from General Mark Milley as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So this is General Brown. And I may not be a fan of all the high-ranking people in the American government, but I do watch and listen to some things when I think that there is some kind of information that I can get out of them. And I used to watch press conferences given by General Mark Milley. Now, I know that Milley and Trump don't get along, but Milley is still a white guy. And you can see that regardless of whether his mind has been fried by liberalism, that Mark Milley is actually quite a proud white man, and you can see that he must have had quite a lot of skill and that he was a genuine soldier in one way or another. So I used to watch Milley, I used to watch how he presented himself, how he used to talk, how he would answer questions. I did not like that the Secretary of Defense was a black, but I listened to Milley, okay? But now Milley is going to be replaced by this black guy. I think it's absolutely horrific that the United States military, if they have a press conference once Milley is gone, and I think he's gone now, I will want to see a press conference where the top military people, the Secretary of Defense, and the top highest ranking general are black in America. Now let me tell you something. Adolf Hitler mocked these blacks in battle. In Mein Kampf, Hitler wrote something like, you know, if a nigger's bullet is lucky enough to hit you, something like that. A bullet fired by a nigger is lucky enough to hit you. Hitler looked down on these people as a bunch of goofballs. And I have mentioned before that you have the Tuskegee Airmen, who were supposedly the black fighter pilots of World War II. When I was in America in 2019 and I spoke to Bernie Davids of the American Nazi Party, he told me that what they don't tell you in history is that the Tuskegee Airmen were accompanied by a whole squadron of white American fighter pilots, and their goal was to defend the Tuskegee Airmen when they went into battle against the Germans, because the Germans would have just chewed up the blacks. So they were protected by another squadron of white fighter pilots. Now let me tell you something. I'm not going to go into black abilities military wise in this video, but I got to tell you, man, that you cannot tell me that General Brown, okay, is the best fucking fighter pilot that came out of the American Air Force. There's no fucking ways that's possible, okay? There's no way in bloody hell that that is possible. How the fuck was it that a black, an incompetent black, can get to be a four-star fighter pilot? That black will now be the highest ranking military officer in the entire US military. This is not possible. There's no fucking ways in hell that that black got there by ability alone. There had to have been lots of affirmative action and lots of other stuff that allowed him to get there. I can't even take these guys seriously. They are flying planes that are run by computers. The plane can fly itself. Those American aircraft are so super advanced. You cannot tell me that this guy could actually engage in a proper dogfight like in the time of World War II or World War I. This guy could never have engaged in any kind of dogfight in the way that Englishmen and Germans, or Germans and Russians, fought each other in World War II. No fucking way is that possible, okay? That the highest ranking military officer in all of the United States military has to be this black. There's a big bunch of fuck-ups that are behind that. There's no fucking ways this is even slightly even possible. And of course, the Jewish New York Times is crowing about it. Oh, the black man, he's now the top general. He's a strategist. He's a tactician. He's this, he's a that. All bullshit, okay? All total bullshit. This is total shit, okay? So, here's my lesson from all of this. Blacks everywhere. Blacks at the top. Blacks in everything. And if you are thinking in businessman mode, non-military mode, like Ben Klassen, because Ben didn't understand military stuff really, you might be overwhelmed by the notion that blacks are everywhere, Jews are everywhere, this is the end. No, my friend, what we are really looking at is a shoeshine boy moment here. That this is the proof that we've reached the end of the movements upwards. That all we have to wait for now is for things to fall apart and collapse. That when you see Jews everywhere and blacks everywhere in high positions, you got to know that the crash is coming. Maybe not the stock market crash, but the crash of civilization is coming. The crash of nations, it is coming. It can't be far away anymore. It can't be far away anymore. And in the same way that Joe Kennedy knew, get the fuck out the market, go and do something else with your money, and you're going to be okay. And Joe Kennedy went on to make even more money. And he went onwards and upwards for the rest of his life. That, my friends, is the future of the white people. That this crash is going to come, but those whites who keep their heads and behave like Joe Kennedy behaved, we are still going to be rocking and rolling. We must just survive and face the crash of all civilization, which is very doable and will be onwards and upwards. If you think that we've reached the point where the blacks and the Jews are ruling all of us and it's going to stay that way, you are wrong, okay? You are wrong. That's just like the stock market hitting its peak. It's reached a point of total fucking insanity, and it's just going to be insane for a while. The insanity is limited, and then the whole freaking thing is going to come smashing down into the ground. And here in South Africa, as the blacks have been taking over more and more, and I'm telling you that everywhere you go, it's just blacks and blacks and blacks. You don't even find a white face anymore. You don't even find Indian faces anymore. You don't find anyone who's not a black in those positions. And yet South Africa is now in the worst state it's ever been. And I've published various articles regarding that. So just be aware that maybe we've got our shoeshine boy indicator that Western civilization has reached the top. It is now simply a matter of time, and the entire thing is going to come crashing down in pieces. And that is excellent. And we must think like Joe Kennedy. Joe Kennedy was totally self-made, and Joe Kennedy went on to have 9 children, and Joe Kennedy even set up funds for each one of his children. He was rolling in the cash from his own ability. He was a man who could see clearly and he could focus on reality. And just a few things from Joe Kennedy that will give you some idea of the correct way to think. It says, for example, on Wikipedia, it says that Joe Kennedy had a real eye for value. For example, he was an active real estate investor who cleared a handsome profit from his privately controlled ownership of Old Colony Realty Associates, an investment company which bought distressed real estate throughout the United States. In other words, Joe Kennedy focused on real value, on reality. He would look at a situation and he'd see, oh, this thing is buggered, but actually it really has value. And if you think in those terms, and if you think in those terms, especially with regard to race, you will understand that just keep your mind clear. Don't be fooled by blacks and Jews, okay? Just keep your mind clear. Look at things as they really are. Don't worry how many blacks are at the top. Don't worry about the population of the blacks. Don't worry about any of these things. Just watch the whites. The state of the whites. How are the whites? That is real value. And we've just got to work on our own people. Everything else is of no importance. These blacks don't amount to a hill of beans. Black success is just a Jewish scam, I'm telling you. If it wasn't for a bunch of liberals, Jews, all kinds of freebies, endless amounts of affirmative action, equity, and all such bullshit, blacks would still be living in huts. That's their natural state, and they will return to their natural state when everything collapses. The sanity and the clarity of thought of Joe Kennedy can be seen in all his actions. And that man was successful at most everything that he did. Just a few quotes from Joe Kennedy, because he was also the ambassador to the UK. And he was a first-hand witness to all the shenanigans behind the fake creation of war with Hitler. And he totally did not like what America and Britain were doing. Here are some useful quotes from him. It says, as fiercely anti-communist as they were anti-Semitic, Kennedy and Astor looked upon Adolf Hitler as a welcome solution to both of these world problems. Kennedy replied that he expected the Jew media in the United States to become a problem, that Jewish pundits in New York and Los Angeles were already making noises contrived to set a match to the fuse of the world. Another quote about Joe is this: Joe believed that Roosevelt, Churchill, the Jews, and their allies would manipulate America into approaching Armageddon. That's from August 1940. Another quote from Kennedy. Kennedy told the reporter Joe Dineen, "It is true that I have a low opinion of some Jews in public office and in private life. That does not mean that I believe they should be wiped off the face of the earth. Jews who take an unfair advantage of the fact that theirs is a persecuted race do not help much. Publicizing unjust attacks upon the Jews may help to cure the injustice, but continually publicizing the whole problem only serves to keep it alive in the public mind," which of course is what the Jews would like. They want to carry on reminding everyone of what victims they are. All bullshit. But this is a very important quote from Joe Kennedy. "During the Battle of Britain in November 1940, Kennedy publicly suggested, 'Democracy is finished in England. It may be here in the United States.' After a controversy regarding this statement, Kennedy resigned his position." So that's pretty much the end of his political career. So there are many things about Kennedy, Joe Kennedy, that show that he was a very sharp man, a very clever man, and that he was also an honest guy, and that whatever his shortcomings were, he did his best for America, and he actually did his best for the Western world and for whites. I'm not saying he's perfect, but I'm just saying that as people go of that time, Joe Kennedy comes out as a very clever man. Very clever man, and he later prepared both his sons to become presidents of the United States. My own conviction is that I think that JFK's task was to get rid of the Fed and to sort out the Fed, and that's probably why he was just blown away. But the bottom line is that if you've got talent, you can navigate your way through all kinds of nasty things. And Joe Kennedy is a pretty good example. And that Shoeshine Boy story shows how he thought. So if you look around the world now, the world is filled with shoeshine boys in positions that they shouldn't be. And I reckon this baby is going to blow. It's just a matter of time. But everything is looking very dodgy everywhere. The more things crash, the more chaotic it becomes, the more our race and our people, using our normal skills, our normal brains, our normal methods of survival, the better we will be able to come out of this and survive this. I want to see the system crash. I want to see things go up in flames, because rest assured, in the same way that Joe Kennedy came out of it, the vast majority of whites will come out of it and will be good to go. And I'm going to end this video with a short video about Jesse Livermore, just to give you a little bit of insight into Jesse Livermore. Jesse Livermore was clever, but he was weak. The one thing that you will see in Jesse Livermore's type of thinking regarding the stock markets also has a place in this time. And you'll see that Jesse Livermore says that people never change. People never change, and the same things that have always driven them always will drive them, that they are driven by greed, etc. And there is greed on the one hand and fear on the other hand, etc. So I think that's also a lesson worth taking away from this. Don't believe this is the end of history. Jesse Livermore and Joe Kennedy were white guys, their minds were clear, and they were clever, and they could see things, and they could see things as they are. They could see the weaknesses of people, they could see the cycles of how things work. So don't you believe that liberals and Jews have won a great victory. In actual fact, liberals, Jews and blacks are sitting in a house of cards, and it's a shaky house of cards, and this baby is shaken away, and it's going to come tumbling down. Just remember that putting lipstick on a pig doesn't change anything. That no matter how much you try and pretend this and that about General Brown and all these other things, an idiot remains an idiot, and an idiot will do what idiots do. And no amount of Jew commentary can change that. Jews can only bullshit people for a period of time, that's all. But the fundamental underlying facts, the fundamental underlying value remains unchanged. Whites rock, and we have all our abilities sitting inside our DNA. No amount of bullshit can hide the reality of what we are. And the more blacks and Jews they pile into this thing, the shakier it's going to get. And you're going to see the European people will be coming out the other side, and we will have to just use our military methods to smash people into place. But all's going to be good. Here's the video about Jesse Livermore.
Legendary trader Jesse Livermore, arguably the most influential stock trader to have lived within the last century. Few stock trading books have had the influence and lasting popularity as this trading classic, Reminiscences of a Stock Operator. Written almost 100 years ago, this book is just as relevant now as it was then. In this video, we provide insight into Livermore's life, his stock trading beliefs, and how those beliefs translate toward the modern day trader. Jesse Livermore lived in the age of telegrams, ticker machines, and manually updated quote boards, not forgetting huge commission costs. A century later, and now we have smartphones, instant information from the web, high-frequency trading, and just about any set of data you want to see to make an educated investment decision. Therefore, you would not be alone in thinking this book should be obsolete. But Livermore himself points out, people do not change. The same forces of fear and greed are still evident today. People will try all sorts of trickery to get your money, some resorting to desperate measures. The message being that the emotions of people towards money remain the same as they did many years ago, and the same emotions move the markets today. Livermore was always fascinated by the markets, and spent much of his time in the bucket shops of New England trying to understand them. He soon developed a skill of being able to read the tape, and to help him remember the patterns for each stock, he would write his theories into notebooks. Soon after, he realized he was able to predict the movement of a stock based on its previous price pattern. It was not long after, at the age of just 14, that he placed his first trade, and became a full-time trader. Livermore had a quantitative approach to price action, which will be familiar to most modern-day traders. Initially, he was a pure technical trader, and his system gave prediction to the short-term movement of stock prices. However, his style of trading developed further over many years whilst continuously studying the markets. At the age of 21, through his trading success, Livermore amassed the equivalent of $686,000 and was subsequently banned from the bucket shops. This led him to the proper brokerage accounts in New York, where he knew his price action system could beat the markets. He was soon to realize, however, that his system was not profitable outside of the bucket shops. The transaction costs and delays of the brokerages meant that he was not able to buy or sell quickly enough as he could before. He continued trading in New York, but before the end of the year, compounded by excessive use of leverage, his trading account slowly declined, and he was eventually wiped out and declared broke. Livermore later said, "The game taught me the game, and it didn't spare the rod while teaching." Despite his losses, Livermore knew his scalping strategy worked in the bucket shops due to the favorable transaction costs and quicker speed. He later traveled to St. Louis, and under a false name, he began to rebuild his account. After once again making a considerable amount of money in the bucket shops, he decided to test his luck again in New York, where he knew real wealth was possible. During his second bout in New York, Livermore made several wrong bets, which again almost wiped him out. He refers to those losses as tuition fees, and says there is nothing like losing all you have in the world for teaching you what not to do. And when you know what not to do in order not to lose money, you begin to learn what to do in order to win. Livermore provides numerous lessons, pointing out that stocks decline much faster than they climb, and you should therefore never average down losses. He suggests taking out half of your profits once you have doubled your original capital, but perhaps more importantly, give yourself time, be patient, and do not overtrade. It could lead you to the poorhouse. Throughout Livermore's time as a trader in New York, he often struggled to navigate his way through the treacherous terrain within the Wall Street culture. That was until he met a fellow trader, nicknamed Old Turkey by his colleagues. Old Turkey had a different approach to Livermore. Instead of holding out for small market fluctuations that had worked so well for Livermore and the bucket shops, Old Turkey would pick a position and hold on to it for the longer term. In his mind, the larger profit gained from the macro market movements far outweighed the short-term benefits of Livermore's scalping approach. It was clear that although Livermore's pricing predictions were right in the medium to long term, they were ill-timed in the short term. In the bucket shops, the strategy was far more forgiving due to the low trading costs than in New York, where it was a different story. The introduction to Old Turkey's more patient approach was a life-changing moment for Livermore, and he later said, "It was never the thinking that made big money for me. It was my sitting." Livermore made his reputation as a short seller during the panic of 1907. Before the panic hit the roads of Wall Street, he had been selling short in accordance with his views of the market and general economy. He watched as the situation gradually got worse, and he stayed short. Aided by his wisdom of his old colleague Old Turkey, he saw very healthy increases in the value of his positions. After a succession of crises and poor sentiment hit the market on October, it finally crashed. The market seized up and required a personal intervention by financier J.P. Morgan to arrange a bailout. At the bottom of the market, Livermore finally took his profits and made his first million-dollar gain. But perhaps more importantly, he realized that he had finally learnt to trade intelligently and patiently. Another key lesson learnt by Livermore is that there is as much to learn from victory as there is from defeat. The learning process isn't restricted to lessons about making money, but also on avoiding the loss of money. And he alludes to keeping losses small and allowing your winners to run, a common principle preached by modern-day traders. No matter how robust the strategy may seem, money is often lost through no fault of the speculator, from developments that nobody can foresee, referring to them as inconveniently timed storms. Having a backup plan for unforeseen events is paramount to limit your market exposure and aid your psychology. One of Livermore's favorite tactics was to buy at the points of least resistance, suggesting that no matter how high the price is, the market can always go higher. Equally, no matter how cheap the price may seem, it can always go lower. This page summarizes Livermore's strategy, which he called the pivotal point theory. Notice how the buy and sell actions were at whole number junctures. And at these junctures, there are periods of consolidation prior to a breakout. Additionally, he makes note that only stocks of interest showing high volume should be considered, and in fact, Livermore says that this is the primary characteristic. For the traders out there watching this, they will know that this theory has stood the test of time and is the foundation used today by some of the best traders in the world, including Mark Minervini, perhaps the most successful stock trader of the modern era. From 1916 and through most of 1917, the Dow Jones lost approximately 40% of its value. At the start of the year, Livermore was bullish like everyone else, but gradually moved to the bearish side. He noticed previous leading stocks had stopped rising, a key indicator that the market was at a turning point. And finally, the bear market began, and he doubled down on short positions. During this period, Livermore took $3 million of profit. Livermore makes the point that the bear market conditions can start long before prices start to fall. In this case, it is wiser for the trader to wait for prices to start to fall before entering large short positions. Your bias should not be long or short unless the market's action confirms otherwise. You must be dynamic enough to switch your opinion in the direction of the market activity. The well-known trader Stan Weinstein later split market activity into stages and would have categorized this downturn as a stage 4 decline. Jesse claimed that the markets never change. The two opposites, fear and greed, are the same today as in 1800, 1900 and 2000. He quoted, "Another lesson I learned early is that there is nothing new in Wall Street. There can't be, because speculation is as old as the hills. Whatever happens in the stock market today has happened before and will happen again." Jesse Livermore's legend lives on today through the work of many others, and he is undoubtedly the most influential trader of our time. The book scores an easy 5 stars. Thanks for listening.
So for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites. We gave you Breaking Bad and all the songs by Creed, all the cast of Friends and trash like Tara Reid, a virtual world of porn so you can spill your seed. Ray-Ban glasses, leggy blondes with tiny asses, frisbee sports and fancy coffee too, energy efficient lights. And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites. Thank the whites.